The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Helen.
Hello, I'm John.
And this is a special US election preview version of the New Statesman podcast. This is a high technology one, so bear with us if there are some snafus as we go along. Because, John, where are you now?
I am currently just outside a little town called Pomeroy, which is in Ohio, just across the Ohio River from West Virginia. So it's a bustling metropolis, as I'm sure you can imagine. But it's lovely. It's very nice and autumnal out there.
That's very exciting because I've been watching season two of The West Wing, as is my election year.
There's no sort of, election in season two.
No, but I always watch The West Wing in election years. It's my little tradition. And they've just been shot by people from West Virginia White Pride. So don't go to any diners that have got swastikas outside them is what I'm saying.
I found out an amazing thing about West Virginia last night. There are people in West Virginia who fly the Confederate flag. But West Virginia only exists because it broke away from Virginia because it was the bit that wanted to stay with the Union. So so the most Confederate state now is one that was never even in the Confederacy. Isn't that a beautiful story?
That is a beautiful story. Also, whenever I hear the word Confederacy, I always hear it in the voice of Cartman from that amazing episode of South Park, you know, when they go and march on Washington with the margarita mixers.
Which is basically U.S. politics right now. So
yeah, it is. And then they like don't they cut the head off a chicken, and then when it like wanders round, whatever it dies in is that's the thing that they get. That's kind of how I feel a bit like about the election now. They might as well just do that at this point.
I haven't seen this episode, but I am looking forward to the chicken decapitation on Wednesday morning. So
it's called Margaritaville. Look it up. But anyway, he calls it the Confederacy because he's Cartman. So that's how I hear it in my head. Tell us about. So you've been on a road trip. Tell us about your road trip in the U.S.
We have, yeah. We've been all over the place. We kind of started off by going up into Boston and New England, and then we crossed the exciting states of Pennsylvania and Ohio, which are places that people only tend to get excited about in election years. And we stopped in a place called Scranton, which is a former mining town in Pennsylvania, which was where Joe Biden was born and where Hillary Clinton's dad is buried, which is traditionally very Democratic, but which might go for Trump this year. It's that kind of blue collar post-industrial place that everyone's kind of watching quite nervously.
So tell me more about what the atmosphere is like in Philadelphia, because from exhaustive playing with the Upshots election predictor, right, you know, if Clinton wins Philadelphia and Florida, then there's really no Pennsylvania and Florida, then there's really no way back for Trump. So everybody is now looking quite nervously towards, you know, it was always, you know, Iowa and Ohio as swing states, but actually this year really Pennsylvania has emerged as the most interesting, perhaps.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's difficult to answer the what's the atmosphere like question, because I think part of the problem that the US has at the moment is that there are places where, you know, Of course they think Trump is going to win because everyone they know is voting for Trump. And like they, you know, if you live in Scranton and you watch Fox News, then you don't necessarily realize quite how much more diverse the US electorate has become over the last 20, 30 years. So there are places, and you know, there are major cities where literally no one is voting for Trump. So it's very divided in that sense, I think. I think Pennsylvania will be an interesting one to watch because the polls show it should stay with Clinton. It's been Democratic since 1988 in presidential elections. But it is one of those states that it's a swing state because it's very, very finely balanced between two big cities in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, which are very diverse and very Democratic. And this whole swathe of kind of rural or post-industrial space in between where everyone's incredibly likely to vote Republican. So it can go either way depending on the turnout. And the votes that Trump seems to be winning from the traditional Democratic coalition are the kind of white blue collar votes in places like Scranton. So we might see Clinton under pressure in Pennsylvania and possibly also in Michigan, where it's a similar story. And this is probably why Ohio is almost certain to go for Trump, I think. It's normally a swing state, but this year I would be pretty confident that one's going to vote Republican. But on the flip side, because Clinton has been very good at... Well, actually, no, it's not that Clinton's been very good at motivating the minority voters to vote. Trump has been very good at motivating minority voters to vote against him.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to pick up with you, is that we've been seeing pictures over here of huge queues in places like Nevada for early voting, an incredibly high turnout of Hispanic voters. Is that something that the US media are picking up on as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. People are now saying in a kind of, you know, fate-tempting kind of way that it's almost impossible to see Trump winning Nevada at this point, just because turnout in Clark County, which is Las Vegas and therefore where most of Nevada lives, was so high and so Hispanic. And the assumption is that most of those guys are going to be pretty angry about the whole let's build a wall thing. So that is going to be a factor. Also in Florida and in North Carolina, even Georgia it's not implausible could actually go for Clinton this year. But on the other side, she is going to be under pressure in the sort of post-industrial Midwest, which has traditionally been a Democratic heartland, but where Trump has been playing surprisingly well because of the message about how, you know, global trade has hurt the US economy and so on. So it might be quite an odd map for the map nerds out there.
Well, and if anyone knows about map nerds, surely you.
I know.
You have made them your people.
I know what the people want. What do you want from me?
Maps is what they want. I think it's been an interesting election because actually people have been very reluctant to make grand sweeping predictions, right? And I mean, I'm certainly in the place of now, if I was asked to put my hand on my heart, I think that Clinton is going to win, but it's not something that I'm going to be at all bullish about because I won't equally well. I will not be shocked to my core if Trump wins, right?
Yeah, no, I'm kind of with you.
I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know whether or not people actually. I mean, people spent a lot of time berating journalists for, as they saw it, calling Jeremy Corbyn's election wrong, calling Brexit wrong. And actually, everyone I feel on both sides of the Atlantic has been extremely cautious about what the polls have said and what conclusions we can draw from them in this election.
There is just a huge amount of uncertainty about what the electorate is going to look like, because I mean, polling is all dependent on assumptions about who will actually turn out to vote. And in this year's presidential election, we've got Trump talking about motivating white voters who don't normally turn out to therefore might not show up in polls. And there haven't been signs of a sort of massive increase in registrations, but I do keep hearing about individual white voters who don't normally vote because the Republicans are too left-wing and namby-pamby for them, but are feeling pretty motivated by Trump. But on the flip side, there's the massive increase in Hispanic turnout. Looks like it's happening. It's not clear on what the African-American turnout is going to be like, whether the black vote is going to be as motivated to turn out for Clinton as it was for Obama. So and there's unusually strong third party candidates in the Libertarian Gary Johnson and also this guy, Evan McMullen, who could plausibly win Utah. So between
I'm
all
enjoying
those things,
Evan McMullen.
There's a huge amount of uncertainty about what the result is going to, who the electorate is going to be, and therefore what the final result will be. So, you know, good luck, Nate
Evan
Silver.
Well, yeah, well, let's talk a bit about Nate Silver. Actually, someone sent me this as a You Ask Us for the podcast, but I think it's probably worth talking about in this context, which is more polling good? I mean, I think there's been very good. I mean, we hashed through some of these arguments after last May's election. I think Zeynep Tufekci in The New York Times has kind of written about this as well, is that and I find it a very seductive thesis that actually more polling has just led to exactly what the campaign coverage did not need, which is more focus on the horse race, right? More, and actually just more polls equals more noise, and it's very easy to report, oh, Trump up one here, Trump down through here, you know, whatever, Clinton up three here, and you actually crowd out substantive policy issues.
Yeah, we've not really heard so much about the substantive policy issues this year, have we? I mean, I've been following this stuff reasonably closely, and I have very little idea of what Clinton's major policies actually are, and that, you know, to an extent that reflects a failing on my part. I haven't gone out and found out, but also they just haven't been widely reported in the way that the horse race stuff or the email server or, you know, that exciting sexual abuse tape that Donald Trump came out with. All those things have got so much attention that I have literally no idea what Hillary Clinton's healthcare plan is. And yeah, I think polling is partly to blame for that. I think also there's a question over how useful this information actually is, because there is a theory that one of the reasons polling fluctuates is not because people change their minds, but because if your candidate is having a bad week, you will feel less inclined to talk to a pollster.
So yeah, I thought that was a very interesting thing, that if basically the couple of days after, like you say, the Trump tape comes out and he's talking about grabbing people by the pussy, then if you're a Trump supporter, you kind of just don't respond in that. Like, it doesn't change how you vote. And I think that's one of the most extraordinary things about this election has been seeing the resilience of Trump support, not just under a sustained attack by left wing and liberals, right, but from his own party, you know. The lack of kind of funding and interest from the GOP, the kind of number of grandees like John McCain saying that they'll write in someone else's name, you know, Mitt Romney being very strongly against him. We'd always got used to this idea that, you know, their parties were just brands. And actually, as a brand, you know, as one of these main parties, you would just get a certain percentage of the vote. But that's sort of been complicated by Trump. He's sort of got the Republican brand, but also he's also calling them pussies, really, as well.
Yeah, and if he wins, it will be by turning out people who don't actually think of themselves as Republicans. I mean, we've met a few people who have told us, oh, well, normally I'm a Democrat, but I do really like Trump, which is kind of terrifying.
So the people you've talked to who support Trump, what are the things that kind of they keep saying?
I think the biggest recurring pattern is just this sense that something has gone terribly wrong in the US economy and that they're at the sharp end of it. It's like, I mean, if you go, we've been through the Rust Belt, which is basically the north of England, only, you know, 10 times the size. You've got all these beautiful, absolutely stunning, some of them cities from built 100 years ago during the Gilded Age, where you can see this was once a really important place and now there's just nothing here. It's just Bradford over and over again, because you know, all these places to some extent were dependent on the car industry in Detroit, I think, and that's gone. So suddenly all the supply chain in places like Akron and Toledo and Youngstown is not there either. So it's this traditionally unionized blue collar workers in places like that that think, well, people keep saying the economy's doing really well, so why don't we have jobs anymore? Why have I gone from like $34 an hour doing skilled labor to $8 an hour working by a petrol station or something?
And I think that's where some of the white nativism comes in, right, is the feeling that actually there are immigrant populations who are doing better, a sort of sense that they've somehow skipped the line, you know, that they're getting special federal assistance, or, you know, they're getting affirmative action programs. And actually these people feel like a minority themselves, but one that is, you know, is left out of any kind of official assistance programs.
Yeah, I think that's definitely in there. Are we going to talk about the parallels with Brexit? Because they do kind of scream at you, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they're fascinating, and I think it's been really nice for British journalists, because we are a ridiculously US obsessed political class, for I think no more complicated reason than it's a lot easier to read the US press because it's in English than it is to read, you know, Die Zeit or whatever, or Le Monde. But this time,
and the West,
you know,
Wing. Everybody, like, we're West Wing addicts as well. Let's not pretend that isn't fact.
And Scandal. But I think it's been interesting to see how much Brexit has preyed on the minds of US commentators that I've been reading, as a kind of example of people voting in a way that doesn't make sense in purely economic terms, but obviously makes sense to them in cultural or identity terms. And also, again, like you say, that just that fundamental thing of not knowing who your electorate is. You know, we saw a really high turnout, much higher than a general election for the EU referendum, and that did mean that people who weren't normally engaged with the political process, who probably weren't being factored into models, you know, they affected the result.
Yeah, I mean, people have been asking us about Brexit, which is not people you'd expect to know about what's going on in UK politics, which I don't think is a great sign for how the country is currently seen by the world. But it's probably because Donald Trump has been repeatedly pointing to these parallels. And I think there are definitely, I mean, the parallel works in two levels. Firstly, the makeup of the Trump electorate looks kind of quite like the makeup of the Leave vote. It's, you know, old people and angry working class people who've been screwed over by globalization.
But also
ideological right wingers and racists.
But also a big sector of people who haven't got degrees, right? I think a huge predictor of Trump support is not having a degree, which, as you say, links into the idea about people who don't feel that they have the skills to succeed in a very high tech economy, and one that is highly globalized. If you're a manual worker, then those jobs are exactly the ones that have been eroded.
I mean, yeah, it feels like globalization has been brilliant for the vast majority of the world's population, but the people who lose out from it are disproportionately concentrated in you know, developed Western countries, where they make up probably about 30-40% of the population, and that's enough to cause this kind of real outcry. So,
and I think, to me, it also means that we're going to have to start talking. There's a great piece in the New York Times about this being a crisis specifically of white identity, and the difference between kind of assigned identities and achieved identities, and saying that, you know, for most, whatever you want to call them, elites or liberals or whatever, you know, it's actually about achieved identity. It's about what you've kind of done and what, you know, where, you know, what your aspirations are and that kind of stuff. But we've probably ignored, you know, the fundamental things about people feel about themselves, that they feel a sense of pride. And if you haven't got a kind of job that people ooh and are and say how amazing it is and how lucky you are to have it, then actually, what are the other things that give you kind of pride in your identity? And that might be, it might be a religion. I think that's been a really interesting force in this election. Or it might be an ethnicity. You know, you're used to being in the kind of dominant group, and we don't like to really talk about that. Which brings me to Mormons. Can we talk about Mormons?
Love a Mormon.
Well, but as you say, Evan McMullen in Utah is polling really well. And Mormons, despite having many of the economic problems of other white Trump voters, are not particularly Trumpy.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I missed the backstory to this. I mean, I think there was probably just a point where Trump made a whole load of rude comments or jokes at the expense of Mormons, and they've not really forgiven him. I mean, yeah, it's just an electorate that hates him personally, but is very conservative, so it's probably going to vote for this sort of Republican guy, Evan McMullen, who's standing as an independent.
But I think the other thing might be that I think some of the Mormons might actually be religious, in the sense that one of the fascinating things is the religious right in America, and the way that it's talked for so long about, you know, how immoral Bill Clinton was. Well, they've got a candidate this time who's been married multiple times. He's had multiple affairs. You know, he's actually, he flip-flopped hugely on abortion and was kind of in favor of it, and then said, now, you know, women should be punished for having an abortion. One of the things that I think I feel like I've learned is that constituency wasn't really as attached to its religious principles as it said it was. Whereas I feel that perhaps, you know, Mormons, and represented by leaders like Romney, you know, do actually genuinely have a kind of moral code that overrides them just wanting someone who cuts taxes.
Yeah, that is interesting. They've definitely sort of separated themselves off from the mainstream of the US religious right, and may vote in a different direction. So, yeah, no, that's that'll be interesting to watch on the night. But I mean, this Utah is sadly going to be a sideshow because of the way the US electorate works. Is like the key thing is not just to get the most electoral college votes, it's to get to 270 or it goes to Congress. So it is plausible, it's not likely, but it is plausible that we get a result in which Evan McMullen gets Utah, which is 6 votes, and neither of the other two get to 270, and Congress gets to pick the next president, which will be, that'll be fun, that'll be hilarious.
Hilariously awful.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they can't even sign off a Supreme Court nominee, you know, that's been nominated by Barack Obama. I mean, what a total bun fight that will be.
Yeah, and it has happened before in history. Yeah, this happened in one of my favourite facts about US history is it took them, after the revolution in which they threw out the monarchy, the number of years before they picked a president who was the son of a previous president was 48. When they picked John Quincy Adams, and that was Congress. That wasn't, John Quincy Adams did not win the 1824 election. He just happened to come close enough, and no one got a majority in Congress. Said, hey, we'll go for that guy. We liked his dad, so.
What other kind of stuff have you noticed from being on the ground?
I feel like I should have more interest. Oh, no, actually, that's a good one. Republicans have been very nice to us.
But Republicans are nice. I mean, this is the same thing as you know, most Brexit voters are really lovely, right? I think you kind of, the rhetoric can be so overblown, you sort of forget that most normal people don't feel that strongly and don't regard anyone they disagree with as a traitor.
But I mean, they kind of do. That's the terrifying thing. It's like, I mean, we spoke to some Republicans in Pennsylvania who were genuinely lovely people. They were so delighted we'd come to see them. They didn't try and tell us we were part of the mainstream media conspiracy or anything. They gave us tea and cake and so on. But who genuinely believe that if Clinton wins, it can only be because the system is rigged and they will need to march on Washington and foment a revolution. And that Hillary Clinton is corrupt and has taken loads of money from she's extorted money from foreign governments and possibly had some people killed. So they are exactly as mad as they are portrayed in some of the more hysterical commentary. It's just they're also, on a personal level, really, really nice people. And that's kind of a difficult contradiction to get your head around when you're sat there having a lovely sort of homemade cake with someone who is telling you that Barack Obama is not really the president and they're going to start an armed revolution next week.
Yeah, I can see that. I think there was some really interesting polling that came out about the number of... the sharp decline in the last couple of decades in the number of people who say, you know, I would be comfortable with and happy to kind of, you know, be ruled by the, you know, the candidate from the opposing side. And that's now an incredibly low level. And I think that's always the kind of flip side, isn't it? If you remember, is I will feel an enormous sense of anger and despair if Donald Trump wins. Well, that is mirrored by an enormous sense of anger and despair that the other side will feel if Clinton wins.
Yeah, I think the media, or not the media as in the individuals like us, but the way the whole industry has gone, plays a part in this, because it is now between, you know, you can have a Facebook friendship group where everyone agrees with you, and you can watch Fox News or MSNBC. You never have to deal with the fact that a significant minority of the population has very, very different views to yours. So therefore, when your side loses, it can come as a genuine shock, because it's like, well, how is it possible that Clinton won? Because I don't know anyone who's voting for Clinton.
I think that's a problem. And I think the other thing is that people are kind of gradually starting to write about is the way that Trump was a great ratings winner in a declining industry, an industry plagued by you know, precipitous drops in print advertising and then small rises in digital advertising, but with most of that new money going to Facebook and Google. You know, actually one of the things that was kind of ratings Viagra was getting Trump on in the early days of his run for the GOP nomination and kind of getting him to say wacky things that everyone was incredibly outraged about. You know, that was sort of just exciting. And therefore they asked to do it more and more. And he just kept getting invited back on stuff when he was still a joke candidate. So he wasn't at that point getting any proper scrutiny. No one was asking him questions about, you know, what's your tax plan or what's your plan for the Middle East. They were just letting him kind of rant and rave about random stuff about Mexicans or whatever.
Yeah, for a while, the Huffington Post actually reported him in its entertainment section rather than its politics section, which has obviously worked out very well and stopped his rise. So well done
I think that will go down as one of the great miscalculations of political journalism, maybe ever. I mean, now Huffington Post has now started running editor's notes saying, by the way, we think he's a quasi-fascist demagogue, you know, and we think he said, you know, sexist and racist things. But the trouble is you can't really pivot from, lol, you know, who's this clown, to, oh, this guy could actually be like the next Hitler, you know, guys, because people just don't, again, to come back to Brexit, people just don't believe it. If you go, well, I could probably see myself voting to leave the EU, as David Cameron said, and then 6 weeks later, you're going, this will be the end of the world and it will cost you £5,000, because people just don't believe you.
Yeah, so we've screwed that one up, haven't we?
So well done, the media. Tell me, what are you going to be doing on election night?
We are going to go to DC because we've got friends there, and we were there. The friend I'm travelling with and I did this trip 8 years ago for the Obama-McCain election. And that night when the result was announced, DC, which is obviously a very African-American city, sort of just erupted into a spontaneous street party. I'm kind of interested to see what it looks like this time round, regardless of the result, because I don't think it's going to be quite the same either way. But it will be.
No, I think if it's Trump, it'll be kind of ululation and rending of garments. And if it's Clinton, it'll probably be overwhelming relief mixed with just profound tiredness, right, at the gridlock that's going to follow.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be an all-night party either way. But so we're going to be there, and I will probably be contributing to the New Statesman's exciting live blog from the ground. So.
Well, that's true. I should do a bit of housekeeping at the end before I let you go, which is just to say that Stephen Bush will be manning the live blog from 11:30 p.m. Our time. We expect to start getting polls closing at 12:30 and 1:00. We're hoping to have a declaration. Based on last time, there was a declaration about, 5 a.m., but as we discussed at the beginning of the podcast, it really depends. If we know Florida and Pennsylvania relatively early, then we could have an answer a bit earlier than that. Yeah. Is there anything else that we should watch out for on election night? Any small things you think a British audience should look out for?
I would keep an eye on Michigan, because it's one of those states that no one was paying any attention to because it's so safely Democratic. And then suddenly in the last few days, the Clinton campaign has gone into a bit of a panic about the possibility of losing it. And if Michigan goes to Trump, then something really could be afoot. On the other side, I'd also keep an eye on North Carolina and Georgia, because if Clinton's winning those, especially Georgia, then Trump has got very little chance. So
thank you very much, John Ellis, for joining us from West Virginia. Have a fun election night.
You too. Thank you, Helen.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by Helen Lewis and me, Stephen Bush, and produced by India Bork. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.